Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Larissa Alexandrova, who's a journalist, poet, essayist, and the managing editor of rawstory.com. Her most recent reporting says that Vice President Cheney and Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld have authorized the use of a terrorist group known as MEK, the Mujahideen Iranian Opposition Group, who are protected by Saddam Hussein, to create unrest within Iran in preparation for an American attack. And she quotes one United Nations official as saying, we're already at war. So I'll be looking into whether or not President Bush and this administration are going to have a war to win an election. And of course, that's already happened in 02 and 04. So it shouldn't be surprising if it happens in 06. And we'll then speak with Dr. Felix Gutierrez, who's a professor at the USC Annenberg School of Communication. Dr. Gutierrez is among the first scholars to focus on the Latinos and the media. He's the first executive director of the California Chicano News Media Association and the winner of the 2003 Society of Professional Journalists Sigma Delta Chi Medallion for Excellence. We'll also speak with Dr. Mark Juergensmeyer. Of course, we'll be speaking to Dr. Gutierrez about the Latin media's role in these recent demonstrations. And of course, there's more to come on May Day, a day without a Mexican. We'll also speak with Dr. Mark Juergensmeyer, who's an expert on religious violence and has published more than 200 articles and dozens of books, including the bestseller Terror in the Mind of God. He's one of the few people that was actually interviewed. Suicide bombers, obviously, they failed to carry out their acts, but we'll be talking to him about the Zacharias Massawi trial and asking him the question, do they hate us because of who we are or for what we do? I'm speaking now with Larissa Alexandrova, who's a journalist, poet, essayist, and the managing editor of rawstory.com. And you've got a piece, most recent piece is about Cheney and Rumsfeld having authorized the use of this terrorist group, the Mujahideen al-Haq, the MEK, as they're called, who were protected by Saddam Hussein. You know, it's very interesting, Larissa. The chief of staff to the former Secretary of State, Colin Powell's chief of staff, Larry Wilkinson, was just speaking this week in Washington. And he told a story about, you know, he's the guy that coined the phrase that there's a cabal running this country, the Cheney-Rumsfeld cabal. And, of course, he's a rare insider who's broken ranks. And he was telling the story about the MEK and how Powell was trying to disband in the MEK. And he finally convinced President Bush that the MEK were a bunch of terrorists and a crazy cult, and they had to go. And Rumsfeld kept saying, I'm going to do it. And then finally, when they had the MEK surrounded after they'd invaded Iraq, then they all said, well, what happened? And Rumsfeld said, I'm sorry, they got away. We didn't have enough troops.
Right. Well, that's actually not true necessarily. They were surrounded at Camp Ashraf.
Right.
And they were disarmed of their big equipment and weapons, but they were largely left alone after that.
Right. Well, I guess they were. The bottom line is that Rumsfeld was saving them for another day.
Right. Well, from what I understand, it was actually Wolfowitz who was saving them for
another
day.
And Cambone, right? Yeah.
And he's now since gone off to the World Bank, and so Rumsfeld, I suppose, is either a shared vision or just continuing taking orders, or I'm not sure. But yeah, no, we had a good many of them. If I remember correctly, it was close to 3,800 in a base facility that we could have arrested them and followed protocol in terms of handling terrorist organizations. Instead, we just took away their big guns and put a couple of guards here and there, but the guards essentially didn't know what to do because a big party was thrown for them, and this is true. There was a big party thrown for them, and they weren't sure if they were guarding or if they were just spending time at that base. But clearly now we see that this organization is now being used for the very purposes that Wolfowitz at the time of the invasion of Iraq had envisioned. That is to say, they're being used on the ground in Iran.
And specifically on through the Baluchi area, right, in the Pakistan
right.
border?
Correct.
And the religious card, how much is that being played since the Baluchis are Sunni and then, you know, they're raiding a Shia state?
Well, I think they're also being used in various other parts of and near around Iran and different regions of Iran, also Kazakhstan, mm-hmm. Kazakhstan rather. I can never pronounce this. I apologize. And what they're doing is a lot of bombing activities where they're bombing oil, high oil areas. They are bombing facilities. Some are in Shia regions. And I don't know if they're operating these as false flag operations or what. And yes, they're actually doing some activity in the Sunni strongholds as well. So even in this past March, 22 people died right around Pakistan, somewhere in the border area also. And that hasn't been reported. I can't find it anywhere. But I'm being told that 22 people have died most recently. So this is quite serious, and we are, in fact, I think the most interesting part of how we got around the using the MEK, that is how the Pentagon was able to bypass the State Department's terror list, which the MEK is on, is that Rumsfeld and Cambone is actually, Stephen Cambone, Undersecretary of Defense Intelligence, is running this operation. And essentially, they came up with a plot to have them simply resign from the MEK and swear allegiance to democracy, and thereby they were converted to non-terrorist status.
Well, that'd be like trying to convert the Reverend Moon. I mean, we're talking about a cult here.
Well, I mean, exactly. And essentially, what we're talking about is a label. The ingredients are the same. Hmm. So they were suddenly no longer a terrorist organization because the MEK is a terrorist organization, and these guys were no longer part of MEK. And we began training them, and we actually put them in with our own special ops units, and they're being deployed as they're preparing really, they're acting as a special ops team would if we were running things over there. But it seems to me that if you want to bypass Congress, you outsource this kind of activity to a foreign agent or organization.
And in this case, a terrorist group.
Correct.
And the Iranians apparently have told some of our people in these meetings that, and other independent people, the CNN analyst and Air Force colonel, that they've captured a couple of these people. So they know what's going on.
Right. Sam Gardner said that.
Sam Gardner, right, yeah.
Yeah, no.
By the way, Sam Gardner also made it clear that he thought, and he's an Air Force targeting specialist,
right.
He made it very clear that this war is going to happen, that these people are quite determined. This is not just a bluff.
No. This is and this is why you see the generals, which is unprecedented. I mean, I know Rumsfeld has said, oh, there's thousands of generals, and this is a small group of bad eggs, but I have never seen generals come out like this and demand the resignation of a Secretary of Defense. Have you?
No, I haven't, and I'm wondering, though, I thought a lot of it was to do with the fact that they don't want to get this Iraq disaster pinned on them. It's Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld. It's their show.
Well, I think that's certainly part of it, but why I think you're seeing a lot of what's going on now is really about Iran. They know where this is going, and they are not pleased, and they also know how the Iraq war was put together. They don't want this with Iran. That's a whole other animal. And
just to quote one of these generals, Lieutenant General Greg Newbold, he writes about this invented war. My sincere view is that the commitment of our forces to this fight, talking about Iraq, was done with the casualness and swagger that are the special province of those who have never had to execute these missions or bury the results.
Right. Yeah, that was very eloquent. I read that, and it's you know, it's true. I mean, none of these people who are in these positions of leadership, deciding life or death situations, have served where their life had to be put on the line, or even on the ground directing in any way. They've always been very much detached from the action. And it's really very interesting how they managed to put this war together without any plan for securing even terrorists. I mean, to say we've secured them by simply removing their big guns is hardly securing them. At the same time, we disarmed the Iraqi military and let them all go off with their own weapons. I mean, I'm sorry, we fired them, rather, right, and let them go off with their own weapons. I mean, these things are just...
That was the guy that Tommy Frank said was the stupidest SOB that he'd ever met.
Oh, Doug Feith. He
right.
was under.
He made sure that nobody that worked for the CPA spoke Arabic, because he figured anybody who spoke Arabic was therefore pro-Arab. I mean, they're talking about the level of competence we have here. You know, again, just to quote Larry Wilkinson, who's our best insider since he was Colin Powell's chief of staff, just the other day in Washington, he said, you know, when the statue of Saddam was toppled on April the 10th, 4 years ago, the Iranians came to the White House through an emissary and said, look, we want to discuss everything. Everything's on the table, because they expected that they'd be the next target, and they were terrified that the American army would turn on them.
Right.
And this was a moment of success, if you will. And Rumsfeld vetoed, and they said, by the way, the authority to speak comes from the highest authority, meaning Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader. And guess what happened? Rumsfeld and Cheney said, we don't speak to evil. So now we have the Iranians in the catbird seat. Evil has won.
Well, you know, it just let's really look at what the definition of evil is here. But be that as it may, the reality is that they've made many overtures, many, since then, and very recently even, through foreign U.S. officials or U.S. officials who are serving in foreign positions, and also directly to the State Department. And at every turn, Cheney has said no. It's a sign of weakness to discuss anything with these people. So it's a problem. I mean, we're clearly not interested for all of the let's take the route of diplomacy, of getting the national community involved. The reality is we're doing exactly what we did with Iraq. On the public face of it, we're saying one thing. On the back end, we're doing a whole other operation that doesn't mesh, and we are once again bypassing our intelligence agencies. And I'm sure later, when there's a Senate report, it will be blamed on them just again, and just the same, even though we're bypassing them like we did the first time around.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Larissa Alexandrova, who's a journalist, poet, essayist, and the managing editor of RawStory.com. Her recent reporting on Raw Story has garnered wide respect and acclaim, including a three-part series entitled Conversations with Machiavelli's Ghost, interviews with the influential neocon Michael Ledeen, the man who threatened to sue me.
As I said, you should call. You should ask him to...
I've interviewed him in the past. I mean, he's just so odious, and these people are so... they have done such ruin to this country, and yet, you know, they still are on the pages of the op-ed pages of the LA Times. It's as though nothing's happened. The neocons are still trying to sell their insane stuff.
Right, but, you know, if you ask him, he'll say that he's a...
he's no longer a neocon.
He's a democratic revolutionary.
There you go. So he's been relabeled. How convenient. He did have the meeting that took place in Rome. There was supposed to be some connection. They were trying to do a swap with the MEC for high-value Taliban targets, and with the Gabonifar being the same fellow that set up the Iran-Contra deal.
Well, if that happened at that meeting, I haven't been able to confirm. The only thing I've been able to confirm is that they were, in fact, discussing Iran. That's true.
And this is a meeting with Ledeen, Rode, Larry Franklin, the guy that just got busted in the APEC thing.
Right, Cassie, right.
And then Gabonifar, right?
Right, and well, there were other people there. Sure. There were Egyptian officials and whatnot. There were SISMI officials. Yeah. Although
Italian
not Polari,
military intelligence.
Right, although not Polari or Martino, as has had been reported. But what I've been able to confirm of that meeting, and there were many others, minus Ledeen, between Rode and Gorbanifer, and on some occasions Larry Franklin. But at that Rome meeting, they discussed Iran in the context of the Afghanistan invasion, or rather the attack, whatever you want to call these, whatever the new catchphrase is. And basically that Iran had been supporting the insurgents on the ground apparently, according to Ledeen and people I verified this with, were supposedly attacking U.S. troops. And that's the only thing I've been able to confirm in terms of the topic of that meeting. In terms of the MEK for Al-Qaeda transaction, I don't know if that took place at that meeting, so it's hard to say.
Well, but it's sort of obviously nobody wanted to. Although what Wilkinson said was that the Secretary of State wanted to disband them and even convince the president, and then Rumsfeld just through his skillful bureaucratic maneuverings never carried out the order and have saved them for another day, and now he's unleashed them on the Iranians in concert with secret teams that Cy Hirsch just reported about.
Right.
So.
Well, but again, this meeting was in December of 2001,
sure.
And we didn't invade Iraq till 2003. So, you know, and there were plenty of meetings, as I said, with Rode and Gorbanifer and Franklin and even U.S. congressmen abroad in Paris and at other locations.
Right.
So there was plenty of time to interfere, as it were, but I don't know if this particular meeting was the occasion on which that occurred.
So, Larissa, from having talked to some of these important players in bringing about this Iraq disaster, have you ever gotten from them any explanation for how they could have been so blind strategically? Did any of them have any idea that an invasion of Iraq would empower Iran, because Iran is so much the winner of this thing?
Sure, and I think we all agree that Iran is the winner. And certainly the loser is Israel, I would say. My understanding is they're now saying that they never wanted Iraq. They've always wanted Iran. But it was the policymakers who said, you know, while we're there, while we're at it, let's go ahead and take Saddam out. It'll be a cakewalk. We'll just go in, and then on our way do we run, type of thing. So they're saying they never supported it, very publicly now, you know, despite what was written in the past by them. So, you know, it's hard to, I mean, I've said, you know, but you guys, you know, whenever I've talked to any of them, that you have said in the past, let's go here, let's go there. But the argument on that is, well, we understood that, you know, based on public statements and what people were putting out there, that Saddam was somehow involved in 9/11, or that basically what the majority of the public was told. So I don't know really what their feelings are in terms of the real feelings, should we or shouldn't we have, but as of now, it is the majority of them I've talked to are saying absolutely not, this was a big mistake, and moreover, this was done very badly. And I don't think that, well, I mean, if you consider their close ties to the Likud party in Israel and how badly this all turned out for Israel, one could see that what they're saying, you could see that they were probably maybe some of them, I don't mean all of them, misled into believing what the public was misled into believing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly you can't say the same for Richard Perle or Wolfowitz. I think they were part of the misleading. But that's where the two arms of the neoconservative movement sort of split. There's the corporatist arm and the intellectual arm, and I think the intellectuals are the ones who are really upset about what's going on and are really questioning this now, whereas the corporate arm is gung-ho and everything's fine.
You mean the whores for the military-industrial complex? I think.
I mean, Paul Wolfowitz.
Right, the guys that have always looking for the Russians were coming, and now it's now they're trying to sell a war with China.
Well, you can see who's by seeing who's left of the neoconservative movement. Mm. You can see very clearly that it is the business arm. Mm. You know, it is the oil. It is the military contractors. It is that arm. Mm. Whereas the intellectuals have jumped ship.
Right. Fukuyama certainly.
Yeah, well, no, Fukuyama, Ledeen appears to have jumped ship. There's others I've talked to who have not yet made public statements, but certainly have expressed
disquiet.
Well, anger, I would say.
Okay. Well, let's then, just in the last few minutes, Larissa Alexandrova, try and figure out when this trigger is going to be pulled, because as I said in the setup piece, it's not as if this Bush administration hasn't used a war to win an election before. In 2002, they used the rumor of war and the war authorization vote and war fever to win the 2002 elections and to put the Democrats in, which is their own fault for being so gutless, on the defensive. And then in 2004, of course, they won the election because of the wartime presidency. We have to stick with it. So in 2006, given the demise of the Republicans and the portent of losing the House and perhaps the Senate, do you think that they'll pull the trigger and make an October surprise? Because remember, you don't really have to do much nowadays with Fox News and these propaganda channels to get war fever going. You can just sort of, you know, stir things up a little bit and the country goes apoplectic.
Well, I mean, I think you do need a trigger event, if you will. I think the WMD argument is ridiculous, and I think most people, even if there were WMDs in Iran or they were near being nuclear ready, that wouldn't people wouldn't believe this story, even if it were true. Let's say, I think there would have to be a triggering event of some sort, and I can't even begin to speculate what that would be. My understanding is that the first phase, that is this motley crew of terrorists and whatnot, being used as special forces on the ground, is the first stage. And then there's some sort of, I understand there's going to be some additional military action as early as next year, early part of next year. And should there be a stalemate, or should it begin to look like Iraq was looking by all these divisions and all these tensions early on, then by spring of 2007 is when they're considering surgical strikes with nuclear weapons.
So not before October, not before the elections?
Well, I mean, again, barring any, I can't see how they would do it unless there was a trigger. That's the only way they could speed this up, because the public is very skeptical.
Hmm. But don't you think they're going to already lose Iraq before October? I mean, they've lost Iraq already.
Oh, sure. Iraq's in civil war. Anybody who wants to say we're near civil war, we're almost there, we're kind of there, that's an absurd. It's an absurd bantying around of just trying to avoid saying what the truth of it is, and that is, Iraq is at civil war and has been for some time, and we've lost Iraq, and we're not. I don't believe there's going to be any opportunity to get Iraq.
So here we are. We've lost Iraq, and we're about to take on a far more formidable enemy. Mm-hmm. That's got all of the levers now, because we've actually empowered them with our stupidity.
Right.
And they can cause us so much grief. They can totally destroy us in Iraq on the ground. They can seed the Gulf of the Persian Gulf with mines. They can shut down the world's economic lifeline.
Sure.
And a war against Iran. Even though there's a war, an incipient war between Shia and Sunni, would galvanize the entire Islamic world. If you think that a few Danish cartoons get people riled up, mm-hmm. wait till we start bombing Iran.
That's true. That's absolutely true. The other issue is that there is a huge pro-democracy movement an organic movement in Iran, and this would literally push them into the hands of the fundamentalist religious leadership. And so, yeah, I think this would galvanize not just the pro-democratic factions within Iran, but also the world, the Muslim world as a whole would come together and say, "See, this is really our enemy," and I think that's very dangerous. And it's, basically, I keep hearing words, the same phrase over and over: "We are playing with fire." I'm not sure how this can be stopped. I think it really does boil down to the military saying no.
Which they appear to be doing. I thank you so much for joining us, Larissa Alexandrova. And let's stay in touch because I'd like to do a follow-up.
Sure.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Larissa Alexandrova, who's a journalist, poet, essayist, and the managing editor of rawstory.com. And I'm now speaking with Mark Juergensmeyer, who is an expert on religious violence and has published more than 200 articles and dozens of books, including the bestseller Terror in the Mind of God, The Global Rise of Religious Violence, which is based on interviews with violent religious activists from around the world, including jihadis and those convicted of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, leaders of Hamas and abortion clinic bombers in the United States. He's currently working on a book on religion and war. And let me just ask you then, out of the gate here, Mark, do they hate us because of who we are or for what we do?
Oh, for what we do. And, we can parse your terms. Who's the they and what do you mean by hate? And I don't think the mass of people in the Muslim world hate America. And I don't think the mass of people who take a very strident kind of jihadi ideology hate Americans as such. But they sure hate the way in which they perceive our presence in the Middle East to be handled, both over time, historically, and more recently in this kind of... And from their point of view, an arrogant and pushy way.
And what do you think is fueling this? How much have we actually been the best recruiter for al-Qaeda? And as much as many people say that all of our actions since 9/11 have fulfilled bin Laden's wildest dreams.
Yeah, in a sense that's true, because there was an enormous frustration on the jihadi side. I remember when I interviewed Mahmoud Abu Lima, one of the people involved in the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, long before 2001. After all, in 93, they were trying to do the same thing that they did in 2001, and that is impress upon the world, especially the Muslim world, that there really was a war going on, and all this talk in their heads about a war and all these imagined enemies really did exist. And when I talked with Abu Lima, you could just see the frustration on his face. It was almost palpable. He said, "Mr. Mark," he said, "you people just don't get it." He says, you're like sheep. He said, there's a war going on. There's a battle between good and evil and right and wrong and truth and untruth, and you're governing the enemy. But you don't see it because the media has blinded you to the truth of this reality." And I think he was even more frustrated with his own people, with the Muslim world, just didn't see it. And, of course, the great achievement of 9/11 was not just that it impressed the Muslim world that America was vulnerable, but it provoked us into attacking in exactly the way that he wanted the evil enemy to act.
In other words, we've been goaded into an endless war by a hopeless fanatic.
Yes, the hopeless fanatic being Osama, I would say.
Right,
you're not
right.
Trying to characterize our own leadership.
Well, there's certainly a symbiosis there, you have to admit.
In a curious kind of way, yes, there's a funny kind of way in which the kind of ideological notion that civilization was under attack, the kind of Leo Straussian vision of world order that was bought by this neocon kind of ideological clique that then took over the White House, that idea, they were equally as frustrated, I think, that Americans, ordinary Americans, didn't see it. They didn't get it. They didn't know that the world was in peril. And so for them, this 9/11 was immediately, for the Richard Pearls who saw this as, aha, now the Huns really have come right to the gate. And now we can use this as an object lesson to impress upon the American people that what we've been saying was right all along, that there really is this attack on civilization, and we need to do something. We need to realign, take control of the Middle East. So for both sides, I think 9/11 was a kind of symbolic opportunity to rally forces around an ideological war that only they saw, a kind of private secret world that nobody else saw until 9/11, and suddenly, you know, everybody bit the bait.
Well, we've had the spectacle of the 20th hijacker, Zacharias, in federal court, mocking the testimony of the tapes and of the desperate calls, both from the World Trade Center buildings and from inside the airplanes that crashed into the buildings and into the field in Pennsylvania. And it's obviously disturbed a lot of people. And 60 Minutes also did an interview recently with bin Laden's bodyguard, who smilingly said, "Yes, I want to kill Americans." And he looks across at his tiny little four-year-old son and said, "And hopefully he one day will kill Americans too." So I don't think people in this country particularly enjoy the idea of people saying the best thing that you can do is kill Americans. But on the other hand...
I don't think it's taken in a personal sense, though, Ian. It's like when Timothy McVeigh said he was sorry that those children had to die in the Oklahoma City Federal Building bombing. Now, he was a Christian terrorist who bombed the Oklahoma City Federal Building with a nursery full of kids for a kind of ideological cause or an imagined war in his own mind. And he was sorry to see the particular individuals that had to be, in his words, caught up in this, but he had nothing against them as persons. They just happened to symbolize a kind of strength of America that their deaths would then help to make a difference in, that would help to contribute to this righting the wrong and changing the balance in the war.
Well, I think what I'm getting at here, Mark Juergensmeyer, is the idea that just because a few nutcases spout off, and just because these people got so lucky on 9/11 in such a spectacular way, I think we've lost our minds. We haven't put this thing in context. I mean, we lived for, 30 years in the Cold War, where every American city was targeted around the clock with nuclear weapons on a hair trigger, controlled by a bunch of geriatric paranoids, and one of those missiles, had they landed on in the city, would have created 9/11 10,000-fold. We survived all that.
Oh, you're absolutely.
So why are we so paralyzed? Why does Homeland Security keep putting out these color-coded alerts, and our leaders keep telling us, you got to fear this guy, you got to fear him, you got to fear him? I mean, hasn't Bush promoted bin Laden as an equal player on the world stage?
Oh, no question about it. He's made him into a national or a supranational enemy. He's raised his status to a kind of transnational status, which is absolutely bizarre. You're absolutely right.
By the way, to prove that point, Mark, we now know that the Madrid bombings and the London bombings had absolutely nothing to do with bin Laden. They were completely independent operations.
Right, yeah. Their own. In fact, even 9/11 was not directly bin Laden's operation, although, of course, he wanted to take credit for it. But, you know, if you wonder how we might have handled this differently, there's no better example than the way which we responded to the Oklahoma City Federal Building bombing. Now, in an interesting kind of way, Timothy McVeigh and Osama bin Laden are really quite similar. Both were religious politicians who kind of imagined a global war going on that other people didn't see. In both cases, they tried to use an act of terrorism to provoke both their own people as well as the enemy into seeing that there is a real war going on. So in both cases, they were really quite marginal people, just a handful, I mean, just a tiny handful in Osama bin Laden, I mean, in Timothy McVeigh's case, really not that many more in Osama's case. And yet, in the case of Timothy McVeigh, we basically ignored him. We just we did not attribute his acts really to an ideological or large political cause. It was just a kind of act of an extremist, a kind of nut person. We didn't invade Idaho. We didn't start bombing, Montana. We didn't start rounding up Christians wherever they were, or people didn't start, you know, fighting Christians on the streets because they thought that somehow they were in support of Timothy McVeigh. And that basically the movement has died away. There have been no significant Christian militia, Christian extremist attacks since the Oklahoma City Federal Building bombing.
But we don't talk about Christian terrorists. We only talk about Muslim terrorists.
Right.
And
why is that?
Yeah, well, give me, what's your version of why it's so?
Well, so it's easy, it's much easier to characterize an other if we don't think they're us. And for most Americans who are used to thinking of ourselves as Christians, I guess it's a harder take to... It's much more difficult to demonize someone who's just among you in a kind of everyday American guise, which Timothy McVeigh was clothed in. So Osama fit the bill, and more importantly, he fit the ideological bill. And this goes back to Leo Strauss and the neocon vision. They had already imagined the world to be at war. They'd already imagined this kind of global confrontation, and it wasn't with Christian militia. It was with an unruly Middle East and a non-Western chaos that they saw at the edge of civilization's gates.
So what do you think is then the real story here, given that we, as I say, we've sort of lost our minds and lost our way? And I remember the old joke of Mort Sahl's during the Cold War, the Russians arrest the Americans arrest a Russian for spying, the Russians arrest an American for spying, and the Americans retaliate by arresting an American for spying. So everything we've done in response to, that was a bad telling of the joke, but everything we've done in response to 9/11, we've punished ourselves. Every time you travel on an airplane, you know that, because you have to take your shoes off and wait in line and all this stuff.
Right.
And it just gives you, to my mind, it's just like, you know, we're somehow we got off on the wrong foot. So what do you think this thing's really about, and how should we deal with it?
Well, there's several levels now. There's the ideological confrontation that, in a sense, has become a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, in that the more the Mideast is regarded as an enemy and treated that way, and these kind of military incursions put America's presence in the face, it then raises the level of support. But, and this is to the credit of most Muslims throughout the world and most people in the Middle East, they still haven't bought it. I mean, most people in Iraq, for example, the Iraqis that I've talked with in my trip there and my visits with Iraqis, convinced me that as much as they may dislike Americans, most Iraqis dislike Americans because they're an occupying presence, not because they're their ideological foe. Now, to al-Zarqawi and some of the jihadi extremists, they see the world as in cosmic war, kind of great confrontation of civilizations. It's kind of like the neocon vision. But most people in Iraq don't buy it. And I think most Americans don't buy it either, the vision that we're in somehow in a global clash of civilizations. They just don't buy it. And that's the saving grace. So it's now a matter of trying to extricate militarily from an imagined war that never really existed anywhere other than in the minds of people who somehow were disturbed about a war, a world that they saw getting out of control, of going awry, whether it was Muslim extremists in the Middle East or neocon extremists in the United States who somehow saw the world as not being ordered the way they wanted it.
But war has been the glue that has enabled this administration to exert its influence and to push through its agenda for which it wasn't elected. I mean, this is a government that goes to great lengths to point out that they are he's a wartime president.
Exactly, because that's what they got going for them. I mean, there's something traditionally galvanizing about war.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly, it's an argument Mary Callender gives in her book Old Wars and New Wars. New wars tend to work the other way. They tend to be unraveling, mm-hmm. and they bring about differences, particularly because of the multicultural nature of most societies now, and so they no longer have quite the galvanizing effect. I think that's what we're discovering in America, that an imagined enemy that should galvanize the public in fact, leads to a very divisive public because we know too much, and we are too diverse to accept any kind of simple-minded notion of an absolute enemy. Mm.
Well, you know, even the old hymn, Onward Christian Soldiers, it says, marching as to war, not to war. So I thank you so much for joining us, Mark, and we should do some follow-ups on this. Because
my pleasure.
Thanks a lot. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with Dr. Mark Jurgensmeyer, who's the author of Terror in the Mind of God, The Global Rise of Religious Violence. He's actually interviewed a number of jihadis and suicide bombers, those involved in the 1993 World Trade Center, etc. Let's now go to the subject of the Latino media and its role in galvanizing these large demonstrations we've just witnessed. I'm speaking with Dr. Felix Gutierrez, who's a professor at the USC Annenberg School of Communication. Dr. Gutierrez is among the first scholars to focus on Latinos and the media. He was the first executive director of the California Chicano News Media Association and the winner of the 2003 Society of Professional Journalists Sigma Delta Chi Medallion for Excellence. And clearly the Latino media played a major role in these extraordinary manifestations starting about a month ago in Chicago and then just a couple of weeks ago throughout the entire country. And of course here in Los Angeles we had 500,000 people in the streets. How much did the Latino media play in mobilizing and in fact, transforming the demonstrations, because as you've recognized in the early ones, there was a lot of Mexican flags and later on American flags. So give us a sense of what's going on here in terms of the media organizing these political demonstrations.
Well, we have a long history of Latino media in Southern California. As a matter of fact, we celebrated last year the 150th anniversary of our first newspaper, El Clamor Público, which translates to the public clamor. Yeah, it started in 1855 when the Yankees were streaming in and basically treating us like we were illegal aliens, even though we were in our own land. And what you see is a following up of that role over the years, and most recently, with the recent demonstrations, the growth of Spanish language television, print, and especially radio, making people aware of what is going on, making them aware of their rights, and making them aware of their responsibility to peacefully protest the government for redress agreements, which is part of our First Amendment rights. So what I heard was that they were, before it was going on, before it actually happened, was disc jockeys on the personalities on the early morning radio shows talking about what was going to happen, interviewing the organizers, counseling people to be there, to bring their family, to be peaceful, not to get provoked into violence, to wear white, and to show people our best face, and to show that we are part of this community.
Well, in a way, you know, I think it puts the rest of us to shame, because I don't think you'd get 500,000 Anglos out there on the streets of Los Angeles, or for that matter, 500,000 African Americans who tend to be the most politically active since they had such a long struggle to get the vote. I think the Latinos are putting the rest of us to shame, even though a number of them can't vote.
Well, that's a good point. A lot of people who are represented here don't have the vote. It might be because of their age, because we have a much younger population. It might be because of their legal status, or maybe because they don't really have anybody to vote for who stands up for their issues. And really, this is a balancing of the debate, the balancing of the issue, because undocumented people, Latinos in general, have been the scapegoats and targets of so much of the right-wing broadcasters and one-sided news coverage, and also a lot of the general audience media. Last week, the cover story on Newsweek magazine had the big headline, Illegals. So before you even open the story, and actually the story was very well done, but what you see in the cover is these people are all a bunch of lawbreakers.
Right. Well, the other day, Lou Dobbs was talking about a plague of leprosy coming from the south of the border. So
I don't know what would be Lou Dobbs would be more afraid of, whether some kind of law passes, these people are all felons, and so they don't return to their country, or that law passes and they do return. What kind of shape would we be here if 12 million of our folks, many of them the hardest, longest workers, weren't here anymore?
Mm. Well, of course, you mentioned earlier in the very beginning here where the public clamor was the paper, and then I remember, of course, the great song by Woody Guthrie about the plane crash of the Bracero. So this, just run us through some of the history of this kind of xenophobia.
Well, just on this particular issue, in the 1920s and 30s, you see the development of Spanish language radio, and the most popular radio broadcaster among Latinos, the early morning show, was Pedro J. Gonzalez. And his show was called Las Madrugadoras, the early morning risers, because so many of our people were doing farm labor in Los Angeles County in those days. Well, in the 1930s, during the Depression, you have the repatriations. About close to 500,000 people across the country basically loaded up on trains and shipped back to Mexico, or some of them were born here. They weren't, had never come there. And he takes a strong stand against these, apprises people of what's happening, these raids that were taking place on Olvera Street and La Placita, which was the gathering place for Mexican immigrants at that time, and warns people about what was happening and speaks out against it. He gets sent to San Quentin on trumped-up charges by the Los Angeles District Attorney, and later when he was up there, the key witness against him recanted her testimony, said she'd been forced to testify. In the 1950s, under President Eisenhower, Attorney General Brownell declares Operation Wetback. And when I was young, I remember I lived in Lincoln Heights, the Happy Valley area. At that point, I remember the green vans going up and down our streets looking for people who didn't look like they belong here and being rounded up under Operation Wetback. And you have La Opinion, the Spanish language newspaper, as it did in the 1930s, warning people and telling people what's happening. And then in the 1970s, under Gerald Ford, Attorney General Saxby operates or declares that he's going to round up X number of quote-unquote illegal aliens and send them back to Mexico. And so you have, again, the Spanish language radio and TV now telling people what's happening, not as much of an activist role as we've seen most recently, but covering the story as a more how it affects you and from the people's standpoint rather than the government standpoint. So this is a consistent role that the Latino media have had to play because we've basically been overlooked and discounted by the general audience media in Los Angeles.
But Dr. Phyllis Gutierrez, as you mentioned, right-wing media, you know, Fox being the paradigm there. I think that, from what I understand, a lot of the Latino media monopolies, I mean, if you go, for example, in Mexico, the most shameful thing just happened in the Congress where Televisa and Azteca were basically voted in for life with total monopolies. And obviously the Congress guys were all bought off. How monolithic is Univision and these media, Latino media monopolies here? I mean,
over the years were mom and pop operations.
Sure.
We have the Lozano family, which still runs La Opinion and has grown into a multimedia or multi-city range of Latino newspapers, but they're rare in terms of local Latinos staying with something and then continuing with it over the years. As it has become more profitable to target the Latino audience because of advertisers desiring to cultivate us as a consumer market, you see more investors coming in from the outside. And so the reality is that very little of the Latino media, the big media, is owned by Latinos or even companies that are based on Latino operations.
And
Univision
what
is one, but right. Their connection is with Televisa, the Azcárraga family, which started Spanish International Network in 1961 and then had to sell it because of some of the things they were doing on the ownership end that was not conforming with federal law, and now Jerry Parencio. But without that, we produce shows for pesos in Mexico City and then show them in the U.S. where we can sell the advertising for dollars. They would not be reaping the profits that they have at this point.
But what about their politics? I mean, Televisa has basically been the mouthpiece for the pre-party.
Well, I'm not an expert. Let me just tell you.
Right.
1848, my ancestors went to sleep in Mexico and woke up in the United States. They changed the border. And I know a lot about Latinos in this side of the country, but
right.
I don't keep up with
well,
Mexican
clearly,
politics other
right.
than what I read in the newspaper.
Well, I was trying to
but
get
clearly
a,
they wouldn't yeah. they wouldn't have their power if they weren't in good shape with the government there, just as the politics here wouldn't happen without the media people being in good shape with
right.
the politicians here.
Well, it seems though that it's the disc jockeys, the employees, rather than the owners of these media outlets that have affected these demonstrations, right?
Well, the disc jockey, you have to make a personal connection, and radio is much more a personal medium than television or newspapers in terms of identifying with an individual. And what you call the disc jockeys, but are really radio personalities, because they do much more than play records. They'll have guests, they'll take call-ins, they'll make comments on your questions. They have a lot of high-tech laugh track and other kinds of technologies. They'll talk about community events. And so their word does mean a lot. It's like a guest in your home or in your car as you're driving to work at a certain time of the day. And so when they talk about something and they counsel you to show up and to bring your family and to bring your kids and your grandparents and all that, it's going to have an effect, and it should. Yeah, I think these media have been exercising their their purchasing power muscle over the years. Now they need to start exercising their political power in terms of telling people that you do have a right here to protest. That's part of the American system, and here's how your voice can be heard. Everything I heard was be peaceful, show your best face, don't get provoked into trouble.
And let's just talk for a moment, Dr. Felix Gutierrez, about the strange politics of this, because there are some odd bedfellows involved. The Latino grassroots organizations like La Raza are, whether they like it or not, they're in bed with, if you will, the Chamber of Commerce and big business, agribusiness, etc. And on the other side, you've got progressive labor groups in bed with right-wing racist xenophobes, the clan types. So the politics of this are kind of murky on both sides, aren't they?
Well, I think they're pretty clear. I know the media side more than the political side, and in terms of our community and people like myself, we all have a standing of how we have been treated and mistreated in this country. We all have relatives. My mother was born in Mexico. My father's family said we've been in California for a couple of centuries. We would go down to Mexico. We'd visit our relatives. They would come up and visit us. All of us within our friends and relationships know folks that may not be here with complete documentation. And we know how hard they work. We know how much they contribute. We know how much they're sacrificing to make a better education for their children and send money home to help their relatives there. So I think those who are looking at the human aspect are finding themselves maybe, as you say, strange bedfellows or in alliance with people they don't normally agree with. But in terms of this issue, I think there has been more of a conformance in coming together. I think what the organizers should look at or would look at who would benefit themselves by looking at would be looking to other immigrant groups and not making this so much of a Latino-centric operation, because whatever law is passed is going to affect everybody of immigrant status.
And what do you think is going to happen on the 1st of May with the national demonstration, basically a day without a Latino?
Yeah, a day without an immigrant.
Yeah.
Well, I plan not to be at work that day, but it's an easy decision for me because that's one of the two dead days that they have at USC where I teach prior to finals. So
sure, and it's worth.
Yeah, so I can make an easy decision, but I will honor it.
Yeah, by the way, a lot of people got fired, from.
Yeah, I know. I've talked to other folks who I know who are not professors, and everyone I've talked to says they plan not to be at work that day. Mm. Now, it's not a broad sampling, but it's people who, working-class people, service-class people. And one of them said, well, she was going to come in the day before and make arrangements to make sure her responsibilities were in good order, but she planned not to be at work that day. Mm. We have had news stories now in the recent weeks of people at restaurants, meatpacking plants up in Detroit and other places who've been fired, a restaurant out in Florida. I don't know what's going to happen in that regard, but I do see that there's a great deal of interest in people in honoring this one-day protest, which is consistent with the Montgomery bus boycott in the 1950s, the great boycott that we had here in the 1960s. There's boycotts are one way of the public letting themselves be heard and making their voice be felt.
But just in closing, my feeling is that the best solution is to decriminalize this whole matter, to make it easy for people to go back and forth. Therefore, there'd be, the idea that somebody has to go back because a relative dies and then sneak back into this country, employing criminals, paying thousands of dollars, and that the criminal brings you in could also be bringing drugs. In other words, if you decriminalize this process, then the only people that will be crossing the border will be bad guys. So I just don't understand why, you know, we're so dysfunctional, because it, in the name of Homeland Security and in memory of 9/11, we got to get real here and not confuse these things, you know.
Well, nobody that got in and was involved with 9/11 came across the Mexican border.
I understand.
And the more you make it harder for people to go back and forth, the more you militarize the border, the more you criminalize the people who are there, then the more people are just going to come up and stay once they're on this side. Mm. And you drop that natural flow that has been going on for centuries. You know, my ancestors came north from Mexico to Mexico when they came up from the Pacific coast of southern Mexico in the 1770s to California. These are migration patterns that have been going on for a long time. And you're not going to stop these by, you know, putting a wall or passing a law or doing things. These things are going to continue.
Unless we decide that that people can cross freely.
And, well, look at Europe. They've got all basically with the euro there.
Exactly.
People cross back and forth countries. You know, the national borders. They build an international economy there. And they're a force now.
I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I've enjoyed talking with you. And let's do it again.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Bye bye.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I was just speaking then with Dr. Felix Gutierrez, who's a professor at the USC Annenberg School of Communication. Dr. Gutierrez was among the first scholars to focus on Latinos and the media, and he was the first executive director of the California Chicano News and Media Association and the winner of the 2003 Society of Professional Journalism Sigma Delta Chi Medallion for Excellence. I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, the engineer, Jazz Shepherd, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer. This program and all previous programs are available at ianmasters.org, where there's also podcasting at ianmasters.org.